to the hymn.
Number 58.
I thought the German national anthem was
Deutschland
über alles.
Yeah.
This was the tune.
Kind, loving, and gracious Heavenly Father, we thank Thee for this opportunity that we have to assemble together in quiet and in peace and study these wonderful words of life and truth. And we thank Thee for this privilege and for each one here and for the wonderful outworkings of Thy plan and the little details that we've been privileged to know. Guide and direct us and help us that we might be strengthened by these words. And bless all Thy dear people likewise around the world. In our dear Redeemer's name we do pray. Amen.
Amen.
Okay. We've got limited time now. And hopefully we can have another session on Ezekiel one of these days before too many moons have passed. Right now, I kind of feel like that magnolia. It represents what we've done. It started out kind of closed, and it opened. Now it's letting all its fragrance out, but it looks kind of pooped. Like it won't last much longer. Let me ask one question before we go into what we do next. Is there anybody in the room that thinks he can or she can give a sketch of how the book's put together? I mean, obviously we did 39 through 48, we got what that is. You see how it opens. But there's an awful lot in between. Are there sections? Are there any obvious sections so that we can say Ezekiel goes from this chapter, goes this many chapters to this many chapters to this, and finally we get to the glorious end? Has anybody done that? Ultimately, that's what I need. Rick,
I haven't done that, and maybe this will stir up minds in a way that might be helpful along that line. The first roughly half of the book seems to primarily focus of the judgment God is going to have on natural Israel, and the problems that culminate with their last kings, Zedekiah, and how he uses the Babylonians there. And with that, though, that being said, we have found that there are lessons having to do with nominal spiritual Israel. At the end of their period, it brings us into the harvest, and then their judgment and doom. Then it seems outside of our last chapters that we've got 36 to the end, and I know it's 37, but I think we had a pretty good...
Yeah, we expanded it.
Yeah. So, from around, and that's what I was just trying to think here, you get around in your later 20s into your early 30s, you've got judgments on others, such as like 25:2, you've got set thy face against the Ammonites, prophesy against them. And I'm thinking that maybe someone has gone through and kind of highlighted what some of these are. 26:2, Tyrus, because that Tyrus has said against Jerusalem, aha, she is broken, verse 3, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I am against thee, O Tyrus. So then we go there. 27 again is, I'm against Tyrus. 28, we've discussed the prince and king of Tyrus and what that symbolically represents with destruction of papacy and then even Satan and such, and we think we came up with the Protestants in Sidon. Then in 29:2, set thy face against Pharaoh, king of Egypt, prophesy against him. So now we're going to deal, there with God's anger with Egypt, and we would look for the spiritual counterpart or symbolic counterpart, that's what I should say, for our end of the age. Maybe the world, maybe civil power or authority is counter-distinct from...
Maybe the Western world.
Yeah. Because some of Israel went afterwards to hide in there, even though the Lord said, don't go there. And so the Lord sent the Babylonians even into Egypt to finish that rebellion of those who have been called by his name. Then in 31:2, you see how it keeps falling in the verse 2? It's to speak against the Pharaoh king of Egypt. Again, some more on that. And in 32:2, take up a lamentation on Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and it gives us some more on that.
33 is the watchman.
33 is the watchman. And
34 is the false shepherds.
Mm-hmm.
kind of like true watchmen versus false watchmen. Okay. By the time, whenever it will be, if it will be, that we try this again, see if you can come up with a table of contents for Ezekiel. Not just by saying, you know, this chapter is about false watchmen or true watchmen, but if there's real directionality in sections, big sections. John?
Well, I just wanted, there's a few overarching things that might be helpful to talk about. One thing that really struck me in the discussion that we had, we haven't really gone into this because it's a study of its own, but the comment was made early on that Ezekiel's unique and that it has the chronology, it has a specific date marking various prophecies. And what really struck me about that is when you think about the picture that we saw of the Lord's glory and, you know, the plan and the way that it moved and so forth, you know, we often talk about the Lord's stately steppings, and I was thinking more of the stately movings, you know, when you think about that. So it's almost like here's this chariot that's moving to a purpose, and Ezekiel is marking various places on the way that are important in the book. So it just struck me how that held together. And that's a part we haven't really got into.
No.
Why those specific dates are marked.
Yeah. Because we haven't gotten into it because it's not obvious yet. Yeah. Okay, Rick.
So, just if anyone's done this, or even as we were just spitting out here, you know, we got to Ezekiel 35, and in verse 2, it's against Mount Seir.
Yeah.
And then 36, we got to the mountains of Israel again. So, we've got judgments of Ammonites, Egypt, Tyrus, Zidon, Mount Seir. Who else we got?
I don't know, but you see, some of these we at least think we have defined. So we have not yet defined Mount Seir. We have not defined Ammonites.
Egypt.
We have not defined Egypt. The whole number of us probably think we have a rough idea of what that would be. So these are defined, these remain undefined. So next time we get together, we ought to be able to have a list of set your face against or prophesy to or for or against all these and be able to pin some labels on them. We've labeled Tyre, Sidon, and the mountains of Israel, I think successfully. But we really need to label the ones we haven't labeled and be able to give a good reason why we think we know what they are. Another one, you know, you got Egypt, but then you got Pharaoh. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like we have Tyre for a couple of chapters, and then we've got the king and prince of Tyre. Mm-hmm. And so when we get to Egypt, he says one thing to Egypt, but then he goes to the leader of Egypt. Well, that has to be considered too. John,
I would also like to know why Assyria is not
in here. Yeah.
Because sometimes in end times prophecy you'll have Egypt and Assyria.
Yeah.
Like in contradistinction.
Yeah. Well, okay, this is important. I know Sandy wants to know who the invaders from the north in Ezekiel 38 are. And somebody else wants to know why some things come from the east. All these are hanging in. Rick.
Two things. One I got to throw out there. Does someone with a fast concordance look up the word Assyria in Ezekiel?
Only one.
Where?
You know, I just said it.
I remembered it about
it's 23 it. Something, I believe. But here, I'll get it.
Twenty-three, seven. Oh yeah, that's our two sisters.
Oh yes,
Samaria, Jerusalem, our two sisters, and in 7, thus she committed her whoredoms with them, all them that were the chosen men of Assyria, and with all on whom she doted, with all their idols she deviled herself, and continued so. throw out another angle. The peculiarity of Egypt is that Israel sought help on several occasions in this Ezekiel setting from Egypt, more particularly than some of these others that are mentioned here.
Asher is mentioned twice.
Asher.
It's in Ezekiel 27:23 and 32:22, which I don't think we've gotten into.
What were those again? I'm sorry.
27:23, 32:22.
Thank you.
Alvin? What's the difference, like, in chapter 6? It says, the word of the Lord came to me, son of man, set your face against the mountains of Israel. We've already established the mountains of Israel. Then I go to chapter 16, and I'll say, the word of God came unto me, son of man, convert Jerusalem.
Yeah, that's another one we haven't discussed.
Is there, what's the difference between the mountains of Israel and Jerusalem?
Okay, and a couple that are addressed to the land of Israel, but that may be connected to or associated with mountains of Israel, because land of Israel is mentioned in this context also, although sometimes separately. Yeah, Jerusalem is another thing that has to be identified. Rick?
One of the elements that's interesting is that in Ezekiel 4, early on in the book, we've got Ezekiel laying on his side the 390 days for the punishment of Israel, and 40 more days for the punishment of
Judah.
So he's showing that all 12 tribes are receiving of the judgment. But if we're looking further, we could think, I think what has already been suggested is that Israel would represent papacy as opposed to Judah representing Protestantism, as papacy was larger and deviated more early because Protestant hadn't come along yet. So Protestant clung to the Bible more, but actually their defilements and their clinging to the Bible actually made them more responsible. So they were worthy of greater judgment. So Protestantism is going to have a heavy price to pay because they've actually had more truth than the papacy had, even though the papacy had, well, just got its judgment in store.
Yeah, and that whole question of double applications is something that's going to have to be sifted through. We've got more than one Ezekiel meeting coming up if we keep pursuing this. Sandy?
I was just wondering if we really knew what the river of Chebar meant, too. As it specifically says, next to the river of Chebar.
Yes, all we did was translate the name, extent of time. The waters at the extent of time, the truth at the end of the age, maybe.
Why would that be in Babylon? The literal river at Chebar was in Babylon.
Well, I know, but you know, when you take prophecy, whether you're in Matthew or Revelation or even here in Ezekiel, Christianity is Christianity, even though part of it is bad, so you call it tares or Babylon, and part of it is good, so you call it wheat or something else. You know, I heard a voice in heaven talking about Brother Russell, but preach from one end of heaven to the other, so that's the whole of Christendom. So it's almost as if it's saying those who claim to be mine, whether they really are or really aren't. So yeah, that's where you would find the truth. You wouldn't find it in Islam. You wouldn't find it in Japan. Carol?
Well, I was thinking of the Jeremiah text that says, Babylon hath been a golden cup in the hand of the Lord. So the truth was in Babylon. It was in there, but not up there.
Yeah.
And one of the translations of Kibar says, great river. Some of the Jews were located here during the captivity. This was the largest artificial canal of Babylonia and was cut by the Jewish captives. So that suggests something that we could look at again. The other one just says a small stream or canal of Babylon, the scene of Ezekiel's visions.
Yeah. Sandy, probably the reason he's by the river Kibar is he was a captive in Babylon. He wasn't anywhere else. It's the only place he could have seen the vision, just from a practicality standpoint. Well, Rick.
An extended time does seem to suggest, in harmony with the book and the historical setting, is that God had it with Israel, and he gave them an extended time, and now the judgment comes, so it's nominal spiritual Israel. He's given them their length of time, and he sent it to the messengers and the reformers, and now he's had it, and judgment sits since 1878 and on. And so the extended time, and they've had it.
Yeah. Okay. I'll tell you what we'll do with the rest of the time now. Different brethren want different things, and we probably aren't going to solve anything big, but we might make luscious little discoveries, or at least raise questions to be thought about. So we're just going to open it up. I know Rick said we might look at something in the temple. You know, we just said chapters 36 to 48, all about the end of the age and the setting up of the kingdom. But there are things there that are lovely. I know Sarah's looked at chapter 13, is it, Sarah?
Mm-hmm.
With some microscopic detail. There's all kinds of things. Let's just kind of have a like a smorgasbord dessert for the rest of the time here now. And just probe wherever you want. Sarah?
I would like to know why, and we've identified both Babylon and Tyre as the papacy, and so I would like to know why they're used under different names. What is the criteria by which the name changes from Babylon to Tyre?
Rick?
I was thinking in the book of Ezekiel that Babylon doesn't particularly represent papacy or Christendom, but Babylon would represent the forces that the Lord God brings against Christendom. So Tyrus in Ezekiel pictures papacy, that even the house of Israel would represent papacy, that even Judah or Jerusalem, when it's being judged down, would represent federated Protestantism. So there's our nominal Christendom there. And that Babylonians can represent everything from the agencies the Lord used to bring down these Christendom, even as they punished Israel and they used them to punish Tyrus, even as it might be the Lord's great army in aspects. It could be the burnt tares in aspects. And I'm just going to throw out here, this is a question, am I forgetting that Babylon isn't judged down in Ezekiel? We know other books, but in Ezekiel.
Yeah.
Is Babylon judged down?
I don't think so.
And should be kind of a clue that Babylon's taking on a different look here than it does in Jeremiah. Jeremiah's totally different.
Oh, it's written about nice.
Yeah.
let me say what Rick said in different words. It's totally repetitive, nothing new here. But it's such an astounding thought to us that have studied so long. Whenever you hear the word Babylon, you think Christendom or papacy. It's automatic, isn't it? And I think in Ezekiel, we can't do that. I don't think the symbolism is the same at all. Because whenever it occurs, whether it's called Chaldea or Babylon or by the king Nebuchadnezzar, whatever it's called, it does not have anything in common with all the prophecies about Babylon. So it's as if here the Lord has just determined to use something different. And there might be a reason for that. If, as we have said, this book is focusing on natural Israel, this might be too natural to Israel. It may be that the book of Ezekiel is going to be for Israel when the kingdom is set up, like Revelation is for us now. In other words, it's going to kind of become their textbook. And they're going to say, ooh, we, Israel, represented that horrible Christendom. And we always thought Babylon was bad. But the Lord said, we pictured that horrible Christendom, and he had to send Nebuchadnezzar to break us up before we got in even more trouble. So, Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, don't represent what we always call Babylon. Probably Israel does.
Right. Feed into that, it's unique because Israel was the covenantic people.
Yeah.
They had the Lord's good things and abused it. So they do fit especially well, nominal spiritual Israel, better than Babylon here, who didn't have the same responsibility. Yet it's interesting that Babylon, named confusion, fits well with the Lord's great army.
Yes. Okay, so I understand this is shocking. And it is shocking, because you get so used to using a certain term, and then when you turn to a different prophet and it has to mean something else, you think, gee, am I thinking right?
What did you write? Elders of John Baker?
Elders of Israel.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just jotted down things here we haven't considered that are probably symbols and need in some future time to be discussed. Mount Seir, Ammonites, Egypt, Pharaoh, Jerusalem, Israel, Babylon, Elders of Israel, John. You're not John's not on the list.
I wasn't volunteering either. No, I know Brother Rick mentioned this explicitly, but I think the other point here is that Babylon is not only is it not judged in the book of Ezekiel, it is the instrument of destruction against all the, not just Israel, but all the other nations between 25 to 35 that Brother Rick mentioned. So I think that's important.
Okay. I'm sure it's important. Exactly what it means, we don't know yet, but it's important. Okay. Bring up something that you want to talk about before we quit, because we're not going to get real in-depth on anything. Mark.
Is there much any information about the sanctuary that could be shared? I don't know anything about.
There's loads. I'm going to ask Brother Rick to do a little of that in a minute, but John's hand was up too, so let me...
This is just a little aside. I found it really interesting when you take a look at those nations from 25 to 35. Just two observations. The nation in chapter 25 is for the Ammonites, and then the nation in... 35, well, it's Mount Seir, which would seem to be a reference to Edom and Edomia. And those are both close relatives of Israel.
Yeah, on their east.
I just find that to be interesting. One through Ishmael and one through Lot. I'm not sure if those are bookends. I'm just kind of wondering... And then I find that really puzzling that you have chapters 33 and 34, the watchmen and the false shepherds, kind of in the middle of this. There's some purposeful sequence there in ending up with Edom.
Yeah, and we don't know what it is. You would expect a book about natural Israel, to have something about the Arabs. Ammon and Moab, of course, would qualify, but I'm not saying that they represent the Arabs, but it's a thought. Carol?
Would you please have Brother John repeat what he said about Ammon and Mount Seir, and which one's which? Isn't Ammon from Lot?
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is?
From Ishmael, if I'm recalling correctly, that Edom...
Mount Seir? Okay, thank you.
On that?
There's a place in Ezekiel, I'm not remembering the verse, but it refers to Jacob as an Ammonite.
Oh, really?
Showing his lineage back to being in the land of Canaan. Can track back, but it's somewhere in Ezekiel, is one of these at the moment an obscure verse to me. And your mother was something. Mm-hmm. And your father, Ammonite. That would have been bad for Jacob as the father of the nation.
How interesting.
Because he'd lived in a dwelt in the land of Canaan, because that's where Abraham came down and so on and so forth.
Ammon is the, well, it's pronounced Ammon now. It's the capital of present-day Jordan. And Edom is below it. Southeast of Israel. Okay. Martha?
This is just a cute little aside that Brother Burns gave in his talk about in chapter 39. He was talking about Gog and, you know, being buried and so forth in Haman Gog. And he said he thought it was a play on words that Haman built the scaffolding for Mordecai and then he was the one that got strung up. So I thought that was kind of a neat little...
Yes, the one who wanted to kill all the Jews got killed by his own devices.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably the meaning there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Sarah?
There's just something that's been ticking in the back of my mind, that it's Jezebel was thrown out of the window by eunuchs, which are not the same as priests. And the eunuchs were very close and they knew a lot about the royal family life. They were in a position to throw her out the window, but she was eaten by dogs, and dogs are non-believers. And it makes me wonder in the destruction of Tyre. In the destruction of Tyre, if she's ultimately destroyed by people who do not believe as she is, or don't claim to be Christians, perhaps. And people ask, who is Gog and Magog? I think that they are outside the realm of her control.
Okay, which may connect with the Revelation text that Babylon is slain outside the city.
There's somebody, but the thing that gets me is that the merchants of Tyre, Judah is one, and Judah should not be there, but they are. Judah is a merchant of Tyre, but so are Meshach and Tubal, and Gog and Magog is the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. If that's the case, they know something about her because they've had dealings with her. And there were things that were said today that naturally I don't remember right now that make me think that somebody knows something about her and exposes her to the people, and they will be disgusted. I think that word has come up this weekend.
Yeah. Just to pick your brain for a minute in regard to Sandy's question, I know you've done a study on the peoples of the earth and classified, was it 70 families?
70, yeah.
70 families. In relationship to that, can you give Sandy a top of your head answer as to whom might likely be in the invaders? You can't.
I think they come from Japheth.
Okay.
They're not Shem and they're not Ham. I think they're Japheth. But I have a color coded, you know me. I have a color coded list. I did email that to Brother Rick, and I don't know if he had a chance to look at it. But it looks at who are the merchants of Tyre. Can you hear that?
Mm-hmm. Did you like it?
Uh-huh.
Voila!
Is that Family of the Earth?
No, you want the next one?
Okay.
There it is. Not color-coded.
Oh, that got rid of all my colors. But anyway, the yellow ones had burdens in Isaiah against them. And the red ones were merchants of Tyre. These are the families of the earth, and they come from Japheth. The forces that come down are coming out of Japheth.
Okay, so basically, Sandy, Japhethites are Europeans, although they might go over into, like, Iran, that area.
The thing that impressed me was that the merchants of Tyre, Meshach and Tubal, and Gog and Magog, and there's Magog in on Japheth's side too. Magog, Meshach, Tubal, they are merchants of Tyre, and they're mentioned as coming down against Israel in one form or another. And I have the merchants of Tyre and what it was that was interesting to Tyre about what they had to give. And then there are burdens against against various countries that ought to be looked at too, because the burdens aren't necessarily countries but groups of people as well that have deserved notice.
Okay. All right. Now I'm waiting for Mark to get back in the room before we start answering his question. So
let's just say, Brother
Davis,
I find saying Japheth is European is misleading, because the Japhethites go, I think, over a much broader expanse. And when we think of Europe, we usually think of Western Europe, which I don't think is involved. I mean, I think that this is particularizing the land from the north. Moscow, if you look on a map, is directly north of Israel. And there seems to be a reference to Russia as the leader. But you've got a lot of, I think, Turkish peoples, Turkey, both in the former republics of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have Iran mentioned and Libya, if you're using a geographic. And I guess I've been watching for some time kind of how those are orienting in orbit, with Turkey kind of the most interesting because it's an ally of Israel's presently, although they're moving more and more away from that and more to Islamic fundamentalism.
I think the prophecy may stress eastern Turkey, which is the Kurds and the Armenians. And of course there's a lot of independence struggle going on in that area too, so it could be that Turkey's been a fragment here before the whole final thing comes. Okay, well that's Sandy, that's pending. Okay.
I'll email that list to anybody that wants it.
Okay.
I want it.
John. Oh, you want it too, yes. Okay. Any other loose ends while we're waiting for Mark? Sister Robin.
I'm in chapter 19.
Chapter 19.
Take up a laser concerning the prince of Israel. Who is prince?
I don't know. I put elders of Israel up there. They all your translations say princes in 19:1. Okay, well, maybe a separate group then. Yes.
Great. Possible suggestion in this setting. When we read down a little further. A lamentation for the princes of Israel, say, what is thy mother? A lioness. She lay down among lions. She nourished her whelps among young lions. She brought up one of her whelps that became a young lion, and it learned to catch the prey. It devoured men. The nations also heard of him, and he was taken in their pit, and they brought him with chains into the land of Egypt. But if we go back to 2 Chronicles 36, we could see that Jehoiakim, after Jehoiakim was taken into Egypt captive, he only reigned 3 months, was replaced by Jehoiachin. Okay. This might be the prince who was as a young lion who was feeling his oats and got snagged into Egypt. Verse 5. Now when she saw that she had waited and her hope was lost because that prince was taken, then she took another of her whelps and made him a young lion. And he went up and down among the lions. He became a young lion and learned to catch the prey and devoured men. And he knew their desolate place, palaces, and he laid waste their cities, and the land was desolate in the fullness thereof by the noise of his roaring. Then the nation set against him on every side from the provinces and spread their net over him. He was taken in their pit, and they put him in ward and chains and brought him to the king of Babylon. They brought him into holds, that his voice should no more be heard upon the mountains of Israel. That kind of suggests maybe when Jehoiachin was taken captive to Babylon and put in prison for quite a number of years and eventually released. But just stopping there, just might thus be a pictorial form of demonstrating that Israel's princes, while they were feeling their oats or feeling strong, boom, one had 3 months, boom, another one had 3 months, and what are we left with? Now you get Zedekiah, who was set up by Nebuchadnezzar, who took his nephew before him into Babylon. So that's kind of just showing that Israel, you know, you aren't learning to work with the program, so you're being taken away. You try to feel your oats, your strength as like a young lion, but the Lord is against you. The judgment sits, and we're just taking you away one by one.
Do you think this would have had a typical application, or would you, in your mind, this strictly apply to natural Israel's fall when they're taken into Babylon?
Haven't got that far.
Okay. John?
Just another element I'm really fascinated with. In 19 verse 12, speaking about the mother, it says that an east wind dried up her fruit. And I guess the east wind, if you look at in Ezekiel 27, it talks about Tyre being destroyed. It's an east wind when she's in the midst of the water that destroys her. And if you look at east wind in the scriptures, it seems to be a destructive force, and I would just like to understand that better.
Okay. Rick?
In 17:10, again, it's an east wind that God is destroying. In 17:10, just because we've looked it over, that would be Israel, not the east wind, I'm sorry, but the planting is, the vine is being destroyed. It won't grow. And that would turn Israel not growing in Egypt when they tried to go down and seek help and the Lord withered it. And there again, that's an east wind.
Okay.
East wind seems to demonstrate judgment of some type, usually calamity. Job had an east wind that the adversary used to blow on him. The Lord permitted it. Yeah. Blew on the house, not him. His house where his kids died.
Well, it might have something to do with idol worship too, because as we saw yesterday, the 25 men on the north wall were bowing to the east, worshiping something else than what they ought to be worshiping. And they were destroyed as a result. Okay, Mark, you were gone, so we decided to wait to treat your question. And Brother Rick brought it up earlier, so let's get into this. And it might be a nice way to end this weekend, because there's some lovely things there. Rick? Start. We'll interrupt you when we want to ask questions. Anybody say, Rick, stop!
Yeah, please, stop. Well, we were blessed with Megason's notes on the temple study because he has so much. And just the, without trying to do too much with the numbers in the temple, which can be very confusing, and trying to always figure out what exactly, how it's being described with all its detail, which we're sure is profitable indeed, but starting with things we're more comfortable with, it unfolds some nice lessons that I think encourage us then to take the time to delve more deeply. For example, we're familiar with what priests are. We're familiar with what Levites are. We're familiar with who the princes would be. And we're also familiar with what places represent in the tabernacle and also the temple.
Back up. Priests and Levites, good. By princes, you mean?
Ancient worthies.
Okay. Thank you.
From Psalm 45. Princes of men.
45.
Yeah. Psalm 45. Yeah. That's it. So looking at it, possibly with this thought in mind, in Ezekiel 40, in verse 2, in the visions of God brought he me into the land of Israel and set me upon a very high mountain, by which was as the frame of a city on the south. High mountain equals what?
Kingdom.
The south equals what?
Earth.
Okay. And so we've seen the city, or as it were, we'll see it ends up being including a temple arrangement in the earthly phase of the kingdom. And then in 3, he brought me thither, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of brass or copper, with a line of flax in his hand and a measuring reed, and he stood in the gate, and the man said unto me, Son of man, behold with thine eyes and hear with thine ears, set thine heart upon all that I shall show thee, for to the intent that I might show them unto thee art thou brought hither. Declare all that thou seest to the house of Israel. Now, it might very well be that this man is Brother Russell. And he's saying to the Son of Man, who we've already kind of identified in the book as representing the church in the flesh during the harvest period. And the Lord used Brother Russell to instruct the church during the harvest period regarding the restitution blessings that are going to come in the peaceable kingdom. And the measuring aspect is one of those beautiful pictures that's used, as we know, in Revelation and elsewhere, that this is laid out with detail by God, and it's fixed, and it has set purposes it will accomplish. It will teach great lessons, but as we were saying, we're not going to spend too much time on the exact measurement part, but we believe there's instruction there. Then we're to show it to the house of Israel. The Son of Man was to show it to the house of Israel, and it's one of our messages is to encourage Israel, literal natural Israel, to look forward to their blessings now that they're back in the land, because it's going to eventuate into their kingdom blessings of being the center of activity and blessings for the world.
Brother Rick, can I ask just a quick question? When you're going through this, it really made me wonder, are you applying this similarly to the situation John has in Revelation? You know, that the Lord sends and signifies these things by his angel. He shows them to his servant John. In that case here, it seems like there's a responsibility to explain.
Sounds good. Yeah, sounds good. Makes sense. In 5, the King James, and I'm going to ask for another translation, it starts out, and behold, a wall on the outside of the house round about.
Temple.
Yeah, that's the key. We're not talking about the house, we're talking about the temple. It becomes more obvious later, but the King James doesn't help. And he's doing this measuring of the wall, and we're not going to delve into that. In 6, it says, then came he unto the gate which looketh toward the east, and went up the stairs thereof, and measured the threshold of the gate. And then we're not going to get into the measurements, which he goes into. And in 7, and every little chamber was one reed long, and then he goes into measuring these chambers. And he ends verse 7, at the threshold of the gate, there's a porch of the gate. And he measures that. Verse 8, he measures the porch and the gate. 9, he measures the porch and the gate and posts. And 10, there's the little chambers of the gate eastward, still talking about the east gate. There were windows on this side and windows on that side, and he's measured theirs and the posts. 11, he measures the breadth of the entry of the gate and the length of the gate. And 12, the space also before the little chambers. And 13, he measured then the gate from the roof of one of the little chambers to the roof of another. 14, he made also posts, the post round about the court about the gate, from the face of the gate of the entrance into the face of the porch of the inner gate, 50 cubits, 16. And there were narrow windows in the little chambers and to their posts. Then there were arches, windows. And then at the end of 16, finally, we get a little bit of relief because we get something we can recognize. And upon each post were palm trees. So we say, aha, palm trees. And as we said earlier, I didn't pick up the verse. Did anyone pick up the verse on palm trees equaling a righteous individual?
Psalms 93.
Pardon me?
It was in Psalms. Psalms 93 or 83.
Yes, right on. Psalm 92:12.
There we go.
The righteous shall flourish like the palm tree. He shall grow like a cedar in Lebanon. So the righteous would grow like a palm tree. So we think this whole, all those verses have been pointed out as representing East Gate of the outer court, and you come up, you have an entrance, you have a corridor, you've got your chambers with windows and arches, and you have a portico and a porch, and there's posts. And without going into all the numbers and, you know, trying to figure all that out exactly, we know that a gate represents a way of entrance, like into the tabernacle, Christ was the gate. So undoubtedly, we've got a symbol of that which becomes more clear, but it's palm trees on the post, so that it seems to represent that in the peaceable kingdom, the entrance into the temple area is for righteous individuals. Just like, almost like in the tabernacle, you'd enter into the tabernacle through the first gate into the court. It's for those who want to leave the worldly ways behind and are approaching unto God. So this is like the first approach of the world toward God, as it were. And so in the kingdom, this might represent how people have to turn toward the Lord, and this would be, you know, the first approach. But I say all that to just say that when you read all these verses, you can start reading it and you can almost get discouraged because it almost seems so confusing and just construction matters that you don't proceed further. But like I say, you get to the palm tree, you get a little breath of fresh air because you got a symbol you can relate to. Okay. Verse 17. Then brought he me into the outward court, and lo, there were chambers and a pavement made for the court round about 30 chambers were upon the pavement. So here we got into the outer court around here, and there's 30 chambers. And there's a way to line them up pretty much like this chart. And let me say at the beginning, this is a chart you could find like in the Finnish Mystery the Brethren had. We're not saying like this is like the definitive best one, but it's a good one. You've got these 30 chambers, and they're part of the wall on the inside. So now it'll come up again. Verse 18. And the pavement by the side of the gates, over against the length of the gates, was the lower pavement. And he measured the breadth from the forefront of the lower gate unto the forefront of the inner court without 100 cubits eastward and northward. Let's reread 19. He measured the breadth from the forefront of the lower gate unto the forefront of the inner court. This is the inner court here. We see another set of three gates on how you get up to what's called the inner court, as opposed to this outer court, which has its three gates, south, east, north. So he's measuring from here to here, and I think he's saying we've got 100 cubits. And from here to here, again at 100 cubits. Jesus' number, but maybe there's more to it than that even. He can give you all his number, but okay, just to start. In 20 it says, and the gate of the outward court that looks toward the north, he measured the length thereof and the breadth thereof. Now I got to tell you, what happened is, the first whole reading that we had, it was this gate of the east that brought you to the outer court. Now he's talking about this north gate that's bringing you into the outer court, and we find it's the same. Mm-hmm. He's just telling us that much. But we do pick up something in 12 that we didn't before. We pick up something in verse 22 we didn't before. We're talking about that north gate. I'll read it. And their windows and their arches and their palm trees were after the measure of the gate that looked toward the east, and they went up unto it by 7 steps, and the arches thereof were before him. So he's saying the north and east gate are the same, but he added that we've got 7 steps that get you from outside the court. You've got to go up 7 steps to at least reach the initial pavement of the outer court. And that seems to suggest this is the way of perfect men. 7 showing that maybe perfection. This is what it's for. Like the palm trees kind of go along with that. In verse 24, after that he brought me toward the south, and behold, a gate toward the south. And again, now it's just a repetition. The south gate's like the north gate and the east gate.
Eight gates.
Pardon
me? I mean, 8 steps.
In where?
Verse 31.
Okay. In verse 27, it says, and there was a gate in the inner court toward the south. So now we're not talking about, we've covered the 3 outer court gates. Now he's going to start talking about the inner court gate. So in 27, he says, there was a gate in the inner court toward the south, and he measured from gate to gate toward the south 100 cubits, and he brought me to the inner court by the south gate, and he measured the south gate according to these measurements. He goes through it in 29 and 30, and like Brother David just brought out, in 31 we pick up again something we're familiar with. And the arches thereof were toward the outer court, and palm trees were upon the posts thereof, and the going up of it had 8 steps. So it's really neat that now you're going up 8 steps. It's higher. Obviously, any step's higher than the lower court, but it's even showing maybe a higher nature. If 7 gets men into being perfect men during human restitution, if getting into the inner court represents a higher nature, this is where the priests and Levites went. That would seem to depict that that's the spirit realm. You went up a step higher than the perfect human nature, as angels are, man's a little lower than angels, sorry. So, okay. But again, the palm trees are shown there, just emphasizing that the court's all about restoring fallen man to perfect humanity. So then he goes through in 32, he talks about the east gate of the inner court, and it's the same. And in 35, he brings them to the north gate of the inner court, and it's the same. And in verse 38, it tells us, after covering these 3 gates to the inner court, and the chambers and the entries thereof were by the posts of the gates where they washed the burnt offering. And in the porch of the gate were 2 tables on this side and 2 tables on that side to slay thereon the burnt offerings and the sin offering and the trespass offering. And at the side without, as one goeth up to the entry of the north gate, were 2 tables. And and on the other side, which was at the porch of the gate, were 2 tables. 4 tables were on this side, 4 tables on that side, by the side of the gate. 8 tables whereupon they slew their sacrifices. I'm just going to stop there to say that it's with the north gate that you see these tables in association. It's not the east gate, and it's not the south gate. The north does point toward the Lord, but do you remember anything from the tabernacle that points out to the north and why these tables where the slaying would take place?
The table of showbread was on the north side of the room.
That's good. Put a hand here and look back in Leviticus 1, where we get our laws governing the various sacrifices. in Leviticus 1, verse 11. And he shall kill it on the side of the altar northward before the Lord. This is the one place we get. This is where you would slay these animals, on the north side of the altar in the court of the tabernacle. So here in the temple, we're picking up that same little bit of a cue. Is it northward, just showing, again, maybe there's an emphasis that this is being offered to God. Even though he's over here, but nonetheless, there's another symbol of the tabernacle. Okay. Without going into the sacrifices, or getting into that, dropping down to verse 44, it says, and without the inner gate were the chambers of the singers in the inner court, which was at the side of the north gate, and their prospect was toward the south. One at the side of the, it says east gate in the King James, but what do others have? Verse 44. South. South is correct. South is south. The NIV, Rotherhams, the Variorium, the Septuagint, they all read south. King James has east.
Would you read it further, Rick, and show us which one? I've got all kinds of directions in verse 44.
Okay. And without the inner gate were the chambers of the singers in the inner court, which was at the side of the north gate, and their prospect was toward the south. In other words, they were looking south. One at the side of the, I'm going to correct it, south gate, having the prospect looking toward the north. And he said unto me, this chamber whose prospect is toward the south is for the priests, the keepers of the charge of the house, and the chamber whose prospect is toward the north is for the priests, the keepers of the charge of the altar. These are the son of Zadok, among the sons of Levi, which come near to the Lord to minister to him. So what we're saying is that, and this doesn't show it right, we're saying that on the north side, in the inner court, there is a chamber for the singers, which happen to be priests, and it looks this way, and there's a corresponding chamber here on the south, which faces the north, which is for the priests, the singers. Sons of Zadok, this would be showing the, this would be the 144,000.
Brother Rick.
Yep.
My margin there, the New American Standard says east gate at the end of verse 44. The margin says Greek reads south. I presume that means Septuagint.
Yeah.
And you're saying the Septuagint's correct.
Yeah. But does anyone here have the NIV or Rotherhams?
I have
the NIV. What's it say?
It's south.
And Brother John, you read something.
Yeah, I've got several here. I'm not sure which one. Sorry.
Doesn't have singers in it at all.
What is your saying?
From 44? There were two rooms outside the inner gateway in the inner court. One at the shoulder of the north gateway facing south, and one at the shoulder of the south gateway facing north.
No singers?
No.
Well, they got to sing the song of Moses and the Lamb.
I thought I had the Jewish version, but it's Darby.
Darby.
It has sound.
Brother David, Mark has Rotherham.
Rotherham, Ezekiel 40:44. And without the inner gate were the chambers of the singers in the inner court, which was at the side of the north gate. And their prospect was toward the south, one at the side of the east gate, having the prospect toward the north.
Oh, my mistake. I thought Rotherham had it as...
Why are you convinced it should be south and not east?
The spiritual and earthly phase of the kingdom of which the little flock will be singing the song of Moses and the Lamb, of restitution and harmony between the two phases of the kingdom being represented on one hand. On the other hand, there's the keepers of the altar pictured here, and it's just a nice, the two ends. But I'll leave it at that because it could be wrong. But that's where we flavored out.
Brother David.
Yes, sir.
Brother
David,
I'm
a New American Standard, I think. Yeah. And it's, says the footnote says the Greek reads south for east.
Yeah, that's why I was saying Septuagint, because this is Hebrew, but if it says Greek, it probably means Septuagint. Martha.
The Septuagint says southern.
Okay.
And my New American Standard says south.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I have a different version of New American Standard.
We have found rather consistently that it depends on what day you buy your New American Standard and what word it uses. And have several places.
NIV has south.
Okay. Thank you.
Maybe Rotherham has it as a footnote or something.
Maybe that's
it. I don't know if he had an electronic copy, but sometimes the electronic copy doesn't incorporate the footnote.
You know, you're exactly right, and I'm glad you brought that out, because we found out that the electronic copy of Rotherham does not include those footnotes, and in our other studies in class, it's been a little discombobulating. Yeah, you're right. Okay. 47. So he measured the court 100 cubits long, 100 cubits broad, 4 square, and the altar that was before the throne. So this is apparently 4 square. Measuring 100 by 100, again we got Jesus' number. And 4 square means perfection, or what God accepts. Even the temple arrangement is 4 square.
By the way, you get 400 that way, which was the mark in the forehead.
That's great. That's great, we do.
I don't know if there's a connection there or not, but...
Yeah, has to do with life. On the one hand, spiritual life. Okay, 48, and he brought me to the porch of the house and measured each post of the porch, and he goes through that. So where we are is we're here with this porch, the length of the porch. Now you're going to get some different thoughts on, I mean, different readings on this. On 49, the length of the porch was 20 cubits and the breadth 11 cubits, and he brought me by the steps whereby they went up to it, and there were pillars by the post, one on this side and another on that side. Does anybody have a different reading that tells you the number of the steps?
Yeah. 10.
You got 10.
Mm-hmm.
Bar John?
I've got a bunch here. This just says steps. The JPS.
What about the Septuagint?
It's 10 steps.
10.
Sylvia? Oh,
mine
good.
Says 10.
Okay.
Is that what you're going for?
Mine doesn't have any number.
Well, what on that, well, 10 has a thought of completeness too, right?
Yeah.
But perfect man is at 7. The great company of the spirit realm is at 8. So when you get up to the divine nature, it's not just one higher, it's not 9, it's 10. It's so grand. And it's so complete. And that is so awesome of a thought that we're just going up, up, up as you approach nearer unto God. And and then I read the King James, you don't even get it. But Brother Megason made note of it, and you pick up on it, and then you go and you see, oh. It's here. Okay. 41. 1. Afterward, he brought me to the temple and measured the posts 6 cubits and so on. I know there's so much good stuff here, but let's get them down. Verse 2, the breadth of the door is 10 cubits, and the sides of the door were 5 cubits on either side. And as we have to keep pressing on here. 3, then he went inward and measured the post of the door. 4, he measured the length of it, 20 cubits, the breadth 20 cubits before the temple, and he said unto me, this is the most holy place. After he measured the wall of the house or temple, 6 cubits and such, verse 6, and the side chambers, 3, one over another, and 30 in order, and they entered into the wall which was of the house, for the side chambers round about. Verse 7, and there was an enlarging and a winding about still upward to the side chambers. And I'm just going to stop and say it's like a winding staircase almost, but you have these side chambers which are in adjacent to where the inside of the temple is proper. And when you read it, 30 is announced. And it suggested that the 30 here corresponds to the 30 rooms here. And it's been suggested that as this was for the priests and their work, it would represent how they might come out and have their 30 different educational courses in bringing mankind up to perfection.
Where did you get 30?
Let's see.
Pass it.
And
41-6.
41-6. 6. Let's see. And the side chambers were 3, one over another, and 30 in order.
This one says 30 in each story.
Right.
Each level.
Mm-hmm. So that's what we were saying, that the number 30 is there, but there apparently are more than 30 rooms just up in and of themselves. Yeah, that's good. I'm glad to help clarify that. Then, dropping down to 12. Now, the building that was before the separate place at the end toward the west was 70 cubits broad, and the wall of the building was 5 cubits 6 roundabout, and the length thereof 90 cubits. That is this building here. Forget angels, that's just what the finished mystery people plugged in. But here's this measurement for this building on the western end, and this is the only verse that talks about it, and this is all we know about it. There's no further explanation. They put the angels in there, but that's maybe not, but that's it.
So all we know is there's a big barn behind the temple.
Yeah. Hmm. 13, he's talking about measuring the temple or the house. And we're going to go all the way down to 16. Still talking about the temple of the house, and he's saying the doorposts and the narrow windows and the galleries round about it on their 3 stories were here. Over against the door, sealed with wood, and that's a funny sealed. Margin says ceiling of wood. Does anyone have something different?
It says paneled in the American Standard.
I think that's better. I think that's better, yeah. That's better. Paneled or covered with wood round about, and from the ground up to the windows, and the windows were covered. Now I just want to stop and say, metal is not mentioned in any of the temples. None of the metals are mentioned. Hmm. And that's a peculiarity. But we have this wood. Verse 17. to that above the door, even unto the inner house and without, and by all the wall round about within and without by measure. And it was made with cherubims and palm trees, so that a palm tree was between a cherub and a cherub. And every cherub had two faces, so that the face of a man was toward the palm tree on the one side, and the face of a young lion toward the palm tree on the other side. It was made throughout all the house round about, from the ground unto above the door, were cherubims and palm trees, and on the wall of the temple. And we already discussed that, but we see how it predominates, this two attributes of God at work to bring mankind to perfection. Verse 22. The altar of wood was 3 cubits high, and the length thereof 2 cubits, and the corners thereof, and the length thereof, and the wall thereof around of wood. And he said unto me, this is the table that is before the Lord.
Brother Rick?
Yep.
Could it be, since wood represents humanity, that with the tabernacle and the temple we had metals, this one is really, to show, even though it's got spiritual aspects to it, is really to show this is the earthly stage of the face of the kingdom in Ezekiel, as opposed to the emphasis on the heavenly stage that we have elsewhere.
That works great. That works great. That works great. And
I'm just pulling these loose ends that we've been floating around for 2 days, and it just seems to be like Ezekiel is aimed at Israel and the earthly kingdom.
Yeah.
You know,
almost undeniable.
Brother Rick, one thing that has really struck me in looking at that is Ezekiel ends with this picture of the temple, and Revelation ends with the picture of the city, where it says God and Jesus are the temple thereof. And so I keep going back and forth between the two, trying to think, I mean, is this the representation that natural man understands? You know, in that sense, where in that. And I guess I'm wondering how God and Jesus are the temple applied to this. You know what I mean? That this would be the, you're, I think, saying the instructions, things that lead man back to God. But I'm just trying to correlate those two, if it's possible.
Well, is Revelation emphasizing the spiritual aspect as opposed to the, and how the spiritual aspect will be engaged more particularly, whereas here we're seeing maybe a little bit more of the practicality of how it's going to be carried out with mankind? I know we've got a lot more detail on the temple here than we do in Revelation, for example. And so maybe the emphasis is, this gives us more instruction on picturing how the earthly phase of the kingdom is going to actually work out, possibly. But I mean, that's just a throwing it out there. Anyone else on that? Well,
can I ask a question?
Yep.
Why is it that the rafters are not supposed to be in the house, and so they've built this whole outer chamber to support rafters as opposed to being in the house? Why didn't they want the roof to be built into the walls of the house?
I don't know.
Is there some significance? We don't know. So you're saying that it's perfect humanity and then the great company, and then inside the actual temple is the church or the Christ?
That's showing the natures.
Ah.
But the church, like we had these two rooms of the singers out here, and they are the priests, the sons of Zadok, that keep the altar, demonstrate that they do come out in their working with mankind. But this does seem to denote the lofty nature that they've attained. And there's probably a lot more to all of this, but that's an initial thought. We got this one article in the temple of furniture, and it's just a wood table. No table of showbread, no incense altar, no Ark of the Covenant. And there's one other place where it mentions this table in our context, and that's in the 44th chapter, verse 16, which we'll read. 44:16. They shall enter into my sanctuary, And they shall come near to my table to minister unto me, and they shall keep my charge. I should back up one. 15. But the priests, the Levites, the son of Zadok, that kept the charge of my sanctuary when the children of Israel went astray from me, they shall come near to me to minister unto me, and they shall stand before me to offer unto me the fat and the blood, saith the Lord God. They shall enter into my sanctuary, and they shall come near to my table and minister unto me, and they shall keep my charge. These are the only two references to this wooden table, but now we've learned that it's only the little flock that gets to approach onto it when they minister. A wood table doesn't seem to lend itself to incense, burning incense or such. We don't have no description of that here. There's no pouring of blood on it or such. But there has been one suggestion. What do the prayer... the prayers of the saints, they offer prayer with incense. So there might be a prayer table being depicted as one possibility. If wood pictures, if it carries through with picturing perfect mankind, restored mankind, maybe that emphasis there again is on the burden of the prayers of the church or the Christ during this mediatorial phase is for the full restoring of mankind, because that's their work.
Let me see if I have an idea that works or not. But in the tabernacle, everything was wood, but it was covered with gold, as if to say, you don't understand mankind's salvation because the spiritual things have to be dealt with first. But we take all this gold off, all the metal off, and you finally got the result. But the things that are missing are the things that did not have wood. The candlestick's gone. The
Ark of the Covenant was gold.
Ark of the Covenant is missing. The golden altar, was it covered? I don't remember.
The golden altar,
was it solid or was it covered?
The altar of incense back in Exodus 30. It was
beaten out of one piece of gold.
The incense altar.
The incense altar.
Verse 1, and thou shalt make an altar to burn incense thereon of shittim wood, thou shalt make it.
Sorry, that doesn't work then. Thought I had something, but I don't.
But if you took the metal off it, you're not offering incense. And let's see, what's the size of this one? It's the length is a cubit, and the breadth is a cubit, 4 square. And what was ours here? Altar of wood, 3 cubits high, the length thereof 2 cubits, the corners thereof and the length thereof and the walls thereof were of wood.
Doesn't work. Sorry.
We can't be burning any animals on it either.
Well, the sacrifice is all complete. I mean, from that standpoint. I mean, at this point, I mean, if depending on which pictures you're looking at, I'm not talking about the subsequent sacrifices, which are the Day of Atonement sacrifices. It's all complete at the time for the blessing of mankind. So why would you have any altars?
Possibly that prayer altar, but there are mention of these sacrifices, and we have these tables.
That's true.
Bowls and hooks. Undoubtedly, whether you believe in literal sacrificing or not, or holographic sacrificing or not, undoubtedly, though, it's the picture of the subsequent Atonement Day sacrifices and how mankind is appreciating what Jesus has done, what the body members have done, and they're recognizing their need to offer themselves and make progress. So we certainly can see that aspect. But it's pulls on the sanctified imagination a little bit. Back in 41:23. And the temple and the sanctuary had 2 doors, and the doors had 2 leaves apiece, 2 turning leaves, 2 leaves for the one door and 2 leaves for the other door. And there were made on them, on the doors of the temple, cherubim and palm trees, like as were made upon the walls, and there were thick panels, planks, upon the face of the porch were out. just once again, even these two lead into the what would be the equivalent of the holy, and two lead into what would be the equivalent of the most holy, and they fold. It's almost like the opening is extra enlarged or extra easy to pass through.
It's also the double door in the New American Standard.
Perfect. And we got our same symbology of the Lord's attributes at work to restore mankind. That's the work emphasis. 42:1. Then he brought me forth into the utter court, the way toward the north. And what do other translations read? King James's utter court.
Outer.
Outer. The way toward the north, and he brought me into the chamber that was over against the separate place, and which was before the building toward the north. Before the length of 100 cubits was the north door, and the breadth was 50 cubits. Now I'm going to say that there's a lot of description here of this that, if someone else has something to offer on it, I'm going to really just jump on down to get to some of the more positive things. So that I'm going to jump all the way down to 42:14. When the priests enter therein, then shall they not go out of the holy place into the outer court, but there they shall lay their garments wherein they minister, for they are holy, and shall put on other garments, and shall approach to those things which are for the people. And some are thinking that what we're talking about is kind of in this area here, that this is the area where the priests move, and this is where they change garments. Almost like in the tabernacle where you have the sides pulled out on the top two coverings where the priests could go in and change, or not out in public, as it were, in the court. These would be kind of like these sides for them. But something we can see is that there they lay aside their garments in which they ministered, for they are holy, and shall put on other garments, and shall approach to those things which are for the people. There's the suggestion that the little flock, not Jesus, but the little flock might have the ability to manifest themselves by manifesting a physical body and appearing to mankind in the kingdom. There's been that suggestion. In 44:19, in fact, I'll back up. We've been talking about the in context, or we had read verse 15 and 16 about the priests, the sons of Zadok, how they were able to go into this wood temple, unto this wood temple. They were able to enter into the temple to the wood table. But now in 17 it reads, "And it shall come to pass that when they enter in at the gates of the inner court, they shall be clothed with linen garments, and no wool shall come upon them while they minister in the gates of the inner court and within. They shall have linen bonnets upon their heads, and shall have linen breeches upon their loins. They shall not gird themselves with anything that causeth sweat. And when they go forth to the outer court, even unto the outer court to the people, they shall put off their garments wherein they ministered, and lay them in the holy chambers. And they shall put on other garments, and they shall not sanctify the people with their garments." So
it says not transmit holiness to the people with their garments in this world.
Very good. So we do learn that these priests aren't to wear anything that causes sweat, and it kind of reminds you of Revelation 14, that their the laborious aspect ends, but their work continues for the faithful little flock when they're resurrected in glory. So these priests are all in glory, so their work's going to be no sweat in restoring mankind, because now they're empowered to know how to accomplish that. And yet here there's this slight possibility that when they leave this area here, the inner court, to come down to work with the people more directly, that they might They might manifest flesh bodies on occasion, possibly.
I've had that thought, or at least that question in my mind for years, but I'd never found a scripture that suggested it, so I didn't see that.
Yeah? Yeah. So, okay, we've got these two suggested here. Then, going back to the 43rd chapter.
Brother Ray,
yes,
I have to ask just because it's funny. 44:20. Can't shave your head, can't have long hair. You just have to have nice medium hair trim. How come? Boy, in the 60s, they would have used that one a lot, I would think. Those that were really upset with everything that was going on, style-wise.
Forty-three, one. Afterward, he brought me to the gate, even the gate that looks toward the east. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east, and his voice was like a noise of many waters, and the earth shined with his glory. And it was according to the appearance of the vision which I saw, even according to the vision which I saw when I came to destroy the city. And the visions were like the vision that I saw by the river Kibar, and I fell on my face, and the glory of the Lord came into the house by the way of the gate, whose prospect is toward the east. And I'll keep reading. So the Spirit took me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house, and I heard him speaking unto me out of the house, and the man stood by me. And this is kind of unusual. You don't see this too often. The man stood by me. Probably the man back in 40. Okay. And he said unto me, Son of man, the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet, where I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever, and my holy name shall the house of Israel no more defile, neither they nor their kings, by their whoredom nor by the carcasses of their kings in their high places. When you read on down further, it's just, again, describing how there's not going to be any defilement to this temple and no pollutions. And the Lord lifts up the standard of holiness in the patterns that he shows them. And we even get down to 11, where he says, And if they be ashamed of all that they have done, show them the form of the house and the fashion thereof and the goings out thereof and the comings in thereof and all the forms thereof and all the ordinances thereof and all the forms thereof and all the laws thereof and write it in their sight that they may keep the whole form thereof and all the ordinances thereof and do them. This is the law of the house upon the top of the mountain. The whole limit thereof round about shall be most holy. Behold, this is the law of the house. So this had that same flavor of entering into the bonds of the new covenant arrangement with the Lord's ordinances, and there will be no deviations allowed from it, and it will be holy, and it is in the top of the mountain. It's in, this is the fullness of his kingdom, and if you want to enter into this is what you're going to have to be willing to conform to and cooperate with. Just a point. The gate in verse 1, he brought me to the gate, even the gate that looked toward the east. But we don't have a west gate, so we're thinking it is the east gate. If you were standing in it, it faced east. But there's no west gate, so we're thinking we're talking about coming in this east gate. And in
Brother Rick?
Yes.
One thing I noticed earlier, the glory of the Lord was mentioned in Ezekiel 11:22 and 23, that after it leaves the city, it says it goes to the mountain which is on the east side, which is kind of interesting, and then it comes back from the east. And I guess this is kind of a simple question, but I think in reading this, when you read the glory of the Lord, we're not talking about the glory of the Lord and all the wheels. We're talking about the glory of the Lord which sat above the wheels. Is that, I mean, we don't have the wheels talked about from this point. I just want to be sure I was reading that.
I think Brother David was also mentioning that when we were talking at lunch, without looking at the verses, we don't seem to have these wheels mentioned, just like you're saying. You almost wonder if it's arrived, the plan of God has arrived at its intended destination.
Right. There's no place to move to any further, because it's like time shall be no more.
Yeah. 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 Now here, because of this gate discussion, we're going to leave 43 and just look a little bit more. 44:1. Then he brought me back the way of the gate of the outward sanctuary which looked toward the east, and it was shut. Then said the Lord unto me, this gate shall be shut, it shall not be opened, and no man shall enter in by it, because the Lord, the God of Israel, hath entered in by it, therefore it shall be shut. It is for the prince, he shall sit in it, to eat bread before the Lord. He shall enter by the way of the porch of that gate, and shall go out by the way of the same. Then brought he me the way of the north gate before the house, and I looked, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord, and I fell upon my face. And the Lord said unto me, Son of man, mark well, and behold with thine eyes, and hear with thine ears all that I say unto thee concerning all the ordinance of the house. And then we have another description of how the Lord is not going to allow any abominations and such to be in this arrangement in the peaceable kingdom. But we want to build a little bit more on these gates. Let's pick out a couple more verses. Pick up here. This is, we're jumping all the way to 46:1. Thus said the Lord God, the gate of the inner court that looks toward the east shall be shut for 6 working days, but on the Sabbath it shall be opened, and in the day of the new moon it shall be opened, and the prince shall enter by the way of the porch of that gate without, and shall stand by the post of the gate, and the priest shall prepare his burnt offerings and peace offerings, and he shall worship at the threshold of the gate. Then he shall go forth, but the gate shall not be shut until the evening. Likewise, the people of the land shall worship at the door of this gate before the Lord in the Sabbaths and in the new moon. The thought seems to be, maybe I'm working backwards here, but the Sabbath days would represent the 1,000-year Sabbath, and a typical Sabbath, and that after 6 days, the previous 6 days of sin and death, as it were, followed by the seventh 1,000-year and a typical Sabbath, during the 6 preceding days, 6 days, particularly the fifth and sixth of those 1,000-year days, you had the high calling, and it ends, and that's shut. No one can enter into the high calling. However, a gate is open by which the people can approach to the Lord so far, and worship, and that's this mediatorial kingdom arrangement in the antitypical Sabbath or new moon. And it tells us that the prince shall enter by the way of the porch of the gate, and shall stand by the post of the gate. And so it seems as if you've got your priests, I said that wrong, you've got your princes, which would represent the ancient worthies, as being the ones by the gate by which the priest would communicate to the little flock or the Christ to these ancient worthies, these princes, and then this would be where the people would be able to worship, getting their instruction through the ancient worthies who got it through the priesthood. So that we've got our princes once again introduced here. Okay. And so in our verse 3 it says, likewise the people of the land shall worship at the door of this gate before the Lord in the Sabbath and the new moon. And new moon has a thought, the moon represents the law covenant, the new moon represents the new law covenant. And kind of makes a connection that way. In 46:9, but when the people of the land shall come before the Lord in the solemn feast, he that entereth in by the way of the north gate to worship shall go out by the way of the south gate, and he that entereth by the way of the south gate shall go forth by the way of the north gate. He shall not return by the way of the gate whereby he came in, but shall go forth over against it. And the prince in the midst of them, when they go in, shall go in, and when they go forth, shall go forth, and so on. So what it's saying is when the people come in to worship, they got to come in from the south gate, and then they have to exit by the north gate. If they came in from the north gate, they've got to exit by the south gate. The east gate is shut. That was shut earlier. So you have to, as it were, recognize that every focal point centers on the altar for ransom sacrifice. So when you walk in this gate, you're looking right up. You'll be looking up all the time, but you'll be looking up, you'll see that altar. And in this way, you look right up, that what you see is the altar, and that's the focus. And anyway, you can't avoid it by like somehow coming in and getting around, coming back out. So it seems that the Lord is emphasizing the whole reason you've got this relationship with me and come worship me is because everything is centered around the sacrifice of my son.
Isn't it saying, too, you've got to go through the whole program? Because if you come in the south gate and go out the south gate, you're not going to meet the ancient worthies because they're not there. You've got to go all the way around.
Perfect. How true. This is the gate where they would be sitting in the porch. Very good. Very good.
No casual tourists.
There's that element that we pick out here. Now this is going to be maybe seeming a little more random, if this wasn't random enough. I sure wish I understood more. But Forty-four, verse nine. Thus saith the Lord God, no stranger, uncircumcised in heart, nor uncircumcised in flesh, shall enter into my sanctuary, or any stranger that is among the children of Israel. So you've got this uncircumcised of heart, the spirit, and no uncircumcised of flesh, the letter. In the peaceable kingdom mediatorial arrangement, if you want to worship God successfully, it's got to be actually and in your heart. It all has to be uncircumcised. No, just trying to keep the letter like Israel of old, but they had a stony heart. So on. Okay. And then 10. And the Levites that are gone away far from me, when Israel went astray, which went astray away from me after their idols, they shall even bear their iniquity. Yet they shall be ministers in my sanctuary, having charge at the gates of the house, and ministering to the house. They shall slay the burnt offering sacrifice for the people, and they shall stand before them to minister unto them, because they ministered unto them before their idols, and caused the house of Israel to fall into iniquity. Therefore have I lifted up mine hand against them, saith the Lord God, and they shall bear their iniquity, and they shall not come near unto me to do the office of a priest unto me, nor to come near to any of my holy things in the most holy, but they shall bear their shame and their abominations which they have committed, but I will make them keepers of the charge of the house for all the service thereof and for all that shall be done therein. And it kind of ends that. And it's generally thought of that the Levites here would picture the great company having their scapegoat experiences, they bore their iniquity, and thus showing what they lost out in not keeping their covenant of sacrifice. And with some of them, they've actually undoubtedly have taught some error along the way here, let the church, you know, misrepresented God somehow. And it might represent many of those that have been spirit-begotten and sincere heart to the Lord, but in a lot of the nominal systems and never got fully freed from the false doctrines therein. Yet the Lord saw their hearts were toward Him, and He gives them their, like we say, their scapegoat experiences and brings them in, but they've missed out on the grandest reward of being of the priest. So that's a suggestion there. Any comments or on that? Or observations? Good morning.
Okay. See what your question started?
Yeah.
Good. We do have to make some. Either we'll have to have an intermission and come back, or we'll have to decide on a closing time. Shortly. I think we said yesterday we wouldn't go beyond four. So, you want to take a break and then have a short whatever is left, or do you want to go to 3:30 and then just quit?
We've been at it an hour and 46 minutes.
Counting time, huh? What's your preference, Martha?
Well, maybe since everybody's kind of people have kind of gone in and out, maybe they need a break. And just take a short 10-minute break for people to go to the restroom.
And then quit at four. Okay, let's do that. Sister Robin, just ask the Lord to dismiss us for a break here.
I just want to thank you for Thanksgiving for what you have given us this day, and we ask for a break to get together with us, and hopefully we'll be able to retain things much better after the break. Which we give thanks in Jesus' name, amen.
Take about 10 minutes, give or take.